Hello and welcome to How Authors Work, brought to you by BetaBooks. Learn more at betabooks.co.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Andrew.
And we interview authors to find out exactly how they get work done.
You're about to listen to a lovely interview we did with Elizabeth Chatsworth, author and voice actor. And the fact that she is a voice actor makes it doubly embarrassing that there's a little bit of an audio issue that pops up from time to time. Now, I've worked to minimize it, and I think the conversation is still well worth listening to. But I wanted to apologize, and here we go.
All right. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for joining us on How Authors Work. Could you start by just introducing yourself to our listeners? Tell us a little bit about who you are and how you got to be where you are today.
Hello, I'm Elizabeth Chatsworth. I am originally from Sheffield in Yorkshire, England, which is the setting for my first novel, The Brass Queen. I earned a BA honours in English Lit and a Master's in Business Management, and then very sensibly decided to leave my job in the corporate world as a marketing manager, fly off to America and try to become a voice talent. So, great career advice, kids, do this at home. It's taken me about 10 years to become an overnight success in this field. I joined SAG-AFTRA in 2010, and I specialise mostly in corporate training, advertisements, medical videos and so on, and some computer games. So if you ever hear an elf, a witch or an aristocrat in a video game, there's a small chance it might be me.
Fair enough. I mean, that also might give you a little bit of a leg up if you ever decide you want to write some high fantasy.
Exactly, right. I have my hobbits and evil queens and that whole bag of tricks ready to go.
I've been this person before.
Yes, exactly.
I read your thing that Jess sent us with some of the background information about you, but as I told you sort of before we started, the disclaimer, it's very early in the morning here, so I had completely forgotten all of it. And you just started speaking before you actually got to the point of I am a voice actor, and I thought to myself, she has a really lovely voice. She could probably do voiceovers and stuff. And then you said, "What's what I do professionally?" And I thought to myself, "Oh, of course she does. This is perfect." So,
thank you.
And it's a real treat to have someone who sounds so nice on our podcast because you know this is our medium is audio, and you're putting me and Paul to shame already. So it's perfect.
Excellent. That was my plan all along.
Okay, good.
I'm going to try to talk normal with now. Oh, God. On the spot, I'm getting so nervous. I'm getting sweaty palms.
You're doing good.
The pressure. Oh, thank goodness.
So one of the first questions we like to ask is about the writing or storytelling process and how people get started. So we like to talk about your routine and rhythms and habits. And it's so when you imagine yourself writing, is there a time of day? Is there a comfortable chair that you always like to sit in? Is there a specific type of pen and paper that gets your creative juices flowing? What are those just mundane details but that are important to you to help you sit down and be creative?
Oh, sure. Well, I don't have a specific time of day because my schedule as an actor is kind of crazy. I never know if I'm going to be running into New York for a session or if I'm on the phone with a client. So it's really not a predictable schedule that I can stick to. So what I've committed to is an hour a day. I can always find an hour, whether it's in 15-minute intervals or if it's a full hour, that I can do every single day, and that's how I keep making progress on my writing. So I've made that commitment to myself and I stick to it no matter what. So if I have to stay up till 3 a.m. in the morning to get it done, then so be it. In terms of tools and technology, because I'm moving around a lot, I use audio cues to really record my ideas. So I have a little portable voice recorder and I'll sit and I'll just talk to myself. Or when I'm walking the dog at the park, I'll chat to myself as I walk around. I mean, fortunately, this is much better than years ago because now people think I'm on a headphone talking to someone. Whereas in the past, they'd have probably just thought I was insane and called someone to take me away. But now you can talk to yourself in public and people assume that you are still sane, which is a good thing.
Once you've gotten your recorder full, do you then transcribe it yourself? Do you go through and listen to it and make notes? How do you get your ideas from the audio to the written?
Well, the easiest way for me is to actually use a program called Dragon Speaking Naturally. Essentially, I plug in my little portable audio recorder into my computer and it transcribes what I've said. Not perfectly, but good enough to have decent notes. I then look at those notes, try and understand where on earth I was coming from when I said this gibberish, and I open up my Scrivener, Scrivener is a wonderful, inexpensive software program that helps you to organize drafts. And I type up my notes into Scrivener using different pages so that you can move around parts of your story very easily. And that's kind of my notice board, if you will, my cork board that I stick all my ideas onto. So this way I know that I've always got a backup. I've got my original audio file that I save on my hard drive, and I've got the Scrivener notes as well. And an important tip for Scrivener, always make sure that it backs up to an online program so that you always have a backup just in case it goes a little insane, because now and again it will seem to eat notes. So having an online backup, like a cloud system, really works well.
Well, that's interesting. So we normally ask a few more questions down the line here about software, but you've already led into it. So I think this is a good segue. So you're using Dragon to transcribe your notes. They're going into Scrivener to stay organized. Is that pretty much your complete toolkit, or do you have other software or any other tips or tricks for people?
Oh, sure. Well, I actually use quite a few different things. There's an online planning board called Trello, which is free, T-R-E-L-L-O. Mm-hmm. And essentially, I put all my to-do lists in there. Now, I don't mean to do like, oh, I have to go to the store and buy butter. I mean my to-do list to do with writing. So it's like invent a new character, work on this setting, and so on. Basically, it's got these columns, and you have your to-do, your doing, and you're done. And I just get a nice sense of accomplishment moving things over to the done column. One of the great things is it's online, so I can access it from anywhere, from my phone, from a tablet, my computer at home, wherever. I can always get into it. So that keeps me organized in terms of my writing tasks.
Trello is great. We've used it some ourselves.
So you have your Trello workflow, Scrivener to write. And are you doing all of your writing in Scrivener? Do you use any other complementary things?
Actually, I do my initial draft in Scrivener, but then I move it out to Microsoft Word.
Okay.
It is a little unwieldy, but I think that it's probably the best writing tool for getting it to a polished finish. So it's something that you could share with people so that you can use the track edits function. And people can give comments and so on right in the document. But that's trickier with Scrivener. And there's actually a host of other programs that I use when I'm in that polishing stage, such as AutoCrit. You can load up an entire novel into this software program, and it searches. It's sort of an advanced grammar check, looks for redundancies, mm-hmm. tells you how many words are in your in a typical chapter and so on, and that's quite a useful tool for really cleaning up. And also I use Grammarly, because when I'm writing in American, and as you might tell, I'm British. So I'm basically writing in a foreign language, so I need a computer program to tell me how to spell things without you. Otherwise, it's just chaos on the page, and no one knows what I'm talking about.
I can't help but feel somehow diminished as an American by everything you've just said.
I didn't mean it that way.
Like you came over here and you had to learn the mongrel version of your language.
No, I think it's the other way. I think she's speaking the mongrel version and she's having the computer help her do it the right way.
Oh, okay. Phew. Okay.
You know what? You are both exactly correct.
Yeah, right? Yeah, so choose whichever interpretation helps you sleep at night.
Exactly.
So let's back up. This is really interesting on the software, and I think we'll actually probably ask you more questions about that as they come up in the stages of the process. Because what we like to talk through is sort of your process from beginning to end, and sort of how you do each step along the way. So if we go back, we've sort of established you don't have a very strict routine, but you have a regular routine in the sense that you've made this hour a day commitment and you make sure that it always happens. When you're at the beginning, we'll try to start from as much the beginning as we can. When you're just brainstorming the very beginnings of a story, where did kind of the nucleus of the story come from? How do those first notions kind of take shape and turn into something that you can say like, okay, I've got something here. I'm going to work from here and turn this into a book.
Right. Well, the inspiration for The Brass Queen, which is my alternate history sci-fi rom-com, came from reading H.G. Wells' The Invisible Man. I've read it many times before, but I was taking a look through it, and there was a character in there that was mentioned, a side character. Essentially, the story is an invisible man attacks a group of people in an English pub called the Jolly Cricketer, and to chase off this invisible demon, there's an American tourist with a gun who shoots him. Shoots him in the, just below the kneecaps, and there's a little trail of blood, and then he's, you know, they use that to track him, and he's eventually found by a mob and comes to an untimely end. But I'm reading this and I'm thinking, who is this American tourist with a gun in an English village willy-nilly shooting at invisible people in the night? I thought, there's a story there.
And I didn't realize the stereotypes of us were so old.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, since about the 1800s, I don't know why. You can draw your own conclusions, but...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So with that little nugget of information about this character, I started to devise a tale as to who this person was. And in my story, he became J.F. Truesdale, an inept U.S. spy who's over in England in the 1890s. On the search for an invisibility serum. And that really is the kernel that grew my story, The Brass Queen.
That's very cool.
So once you have that kernel, obviously you're getting inspired by H.G. Wells. And we know you speak into a recorder, but it sounds like you also have a pretty robust set of software tools. Did you then begin to make notes about this idea? Did you outline? And what form did that brainstorming, those early idea forming sessions take for you as far as the structure of them?
Oh, sure. Well, originally it's more like a dream state. You just sort of imagine this as a sort of a movie in your head, playing out the different things. When it got to something that made some kind of sense, that's when I first started jotting down notes. Originally, I went old school and put post-it notes all over the bedroom wall, which my husband loved, like a fabulous decorating detail. And I kept moving them around, and he's an IT manager, so he said, you know, there may be software that could help you with this kind of thing. And that's when I actually found Scrivener. So that was a great start to actually organizing those ideas. And it just became notes that I moved around and until eventually I found my way into the story.
And when you were using post-it notes, were you just using one color? Were you using various colors? Were you grouping them? Were you grouping them by character, by chapter? Were you trying to organize them chronologically on the wall? Did any of that begin to emerge as you were using post-its?
Basically all of that. You are correct on every facet. I had purple for this and yellow for that and the timeline and the whole thing. It was really getting insane. It started to look like one of those rooms where they're trying to track down serial killers and they've got lines everywhere. So I'm really glad that I moved over to software because it was a much better way to do it.
I know some people find the tactile and the physical artifacts and rearranging the physical artifacts to be an important part of their process.
Yes.
It's interesting to hear that was not a part of, you didn't feel like you lost anything when you moved to software. Is that correct?
Correct. I think because my brain still thinks of it as post-its on the wall, it hasn't really, it's not evolved enough to understand that this is all virtual now and doesn't really exist. It's still seeing it that same way. And Scrivener actually has that corkboard in, so I'm literally still moving electronic index cards around on the corkboard function. So it feels very much the same, even though it isn't.
The idea that you're mentally tricking yourself, or that there's a... that you have created a mental discipline that allows you to do both at the same time is pretty interesting. So once you have a bunch of those digital post-its assembled, do you then write that out as a document, as a guide document? Do you then transfer? You said you're using a to-do list. Are you creating a to-do list outline? Is that sort of the next step?
Yes. Essentially, I write front to back. I start on page 1 and I finish on page 350. And I work my way through chapter by chapter. I know that some people just jump in at different points, you know, the most exciting points and piece it all together. But for me, just linear tends to work well. I write each chapter in layers. So essentially, I'll start with the dialogue first. I find dialogue very easy because talking comes naturally, she said, usually. And that's so I have the dialogue down so that I understand where the characters are coming from. Then I put down their inner thoughts and feelings. Then I'll add the physical actions. And then finally I work on setting. The reason I do this is because originally I would start trying to write the perfect scene with the perfect setting description and, oh, the burgundy carpet, oh, the teal sofa, you know, and I just wrote on and on and on. It's like way too much. I mean, nobody needs that much decorating information in a novel. So by doing it in these layers, I keep it simple for myself. I don't spend a lot of time super working every detail. I just work through that layer of dialogue, work through that layer of action, work through that layer of setting, and then in the end, I massage it all together so that hopefully it reads as an entertaining chapter.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's very cool. Is it always that order that you always? It's always the dialogue first, and then. I'm sorry, I didn't catch what you said. What's the middle layer and then the...
Sure. The inner thoughts and the actions and then the setting last. I think it's the dialogue first for me because it plays like a movie in my head. I see these characters bickering and I see them saying foolish things and so on. And it makes me laugh. And if it makes me laugh, then it's going on the page. Or if it's tugging my heartstrings, then it's going on the page. If it's just, oh, hey, I'm going to town now and it's not particularly interesting, it doesn't really need to be there. So it helps me to edit down before I even get it on the page as to what's really pertinent to these characters in this situation.
Yeah, that's interesting. I kind of write that way too, but I was wondering if you had, it seems like you do this in a more sophisticated way than I do, but of course it could just be that you sound more sophisticated than I do. So
it's all the accent.
but I really relate to any time I'm having a scene where it isn't crystal clear to me exactly what's happening, I always just try to write the dialogue first. And then I'll even oftentimes just write it as bullets where I don't even bother punctuating or anything. I often will not even write a character attribution. And so if there's three or four people talking in a scene, to me, it's actually kind of one of those important things that like I should basically be able to just dump out all the words. And as long as everyone's lines are on their own line, if it's not obvious to me who's speaking, then like it's not probably working, right? So I'll do that. But then usually from there, that is really barely more than an outline because it's so just barfed onto the page. And then from there, I'll usually go back and edit. And when I do the editorial pass, I actually try to write all the, like write it for real, right? With all the actions and inner thoughts and attributions and descriptions and setting and everything. And so it sounds like you're doing it not in kind of two passes like that, but three or four.
Yes.
Kind of just like incrementally building in more detail. So that's really interesting.
It's all very personal as to what works for you. It works for me because I sort of build the novel as a structure and I see it in terms of layers and scenes and adding different levels of detail as you get further and further in, whereas other folks may see it as a spider web or a giant bucket of frogs or whoever, you know, whatever works for them. And it's all right. That's the important thing to bear in mind. Whatever works for you is the right way. And you can always try new ways and there's no harm in that either. But whatever actually gets you to produce and feel good about what you're producing, then that's the right way.
That's a big part of why we ask authors all these questions, because everyone has a slightly different way of doing things and it's working for them. And so people should feel confident that what's working for them is the right way for them to do it.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned at the beginning, jokingly, things like teal carpet and the setting. But since you are writing in an alternative history setting, are you using each of these passes to do different layers of research? Say, when you're doing dialogue, are you doing like idiomatic research or language research, and then the next phase you might be doing setting and, you know, professional research? Are you doing research as you go, or are you going back and fact checking later? Where does the research for the historical stuff come in for you?
Yes, I think it comes essentially in the middle part of the process. The serious fact checking really comes at the end when you have everything polished. You know, you want to go back and double check every fact. You know, if Queen Victoria was on the throne, that's an important fact to know versus saying, oh, it was King Henry VIII. No, it really wasn't. You should know those things in terms of your year, even in an alternate history, if it's a parallel to this world. So I do some fact checking in the middle of the novel, essentially just to see if I find any other nuggets that might lead into a new avenue of interest. So it's more to open new doors than to specifically worry about whether this word was used in 1893 or whatever. So it's just about avenues, but the serious fact checking where you want to get all your dates and times and your timeline correct, that really comes at the end with the polished novel. So I guess my answer is in the middle and at the end.
Yes. The answer is yes, all.
Yes.
That's great. So you are essentially writing each chapter three times as you go through. Now, I'm not sure if you mentioned this and I missed it or if we need to go back. Are you trying to do the dialogue pass for a chapter at a time or for the whole thing? Are you doing chunks or do you say I'm going to form a chapter completely, then do the next chapter?
Yes, I form a chapter completely and then move on to the next chapter. I mean, I'm always aware that I will be coming back for a final revision. So an important thing that I had to learn was to let it go at a certain point. If it's 75% of the way there, that's more than enough to move on. I don't have to make it perfect at this stage.
So what sounds like maybe you were doing a little editing as you went as well, is that?
Yes, I do, which... For some folks, that does not work at all because it's going to just stop you dead worrying about, well, is this the right word? But for me, some editing as I go is important. If it doesn't feel right, then I have a difficulty moving on to that next chapter. So I have to get the feel right, even if I know it's not going to be those exact words by the end.
And I imagine if you're synthesizing those three stages, a little editing will just be natural to make them flow together.
Yes.
As you're adding those layers. Okay, very interesting.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I think I can kind of relate to it's okay to leave it at sort of the 75% mark, but I'm in the same boat as you that I sort of need to go linearly. And if I know that the last chapter like didn't work, it's really hard for me to write the next chapter. Although I'll tell you that like the one secret I've learned, well, secret, whatever, a lot of people jump around and have no problem doing it and are completely comfortable. As you pointed out, I've had one trick that I've done since that's not me. I don't normally like to jump around. And that is basically to write this kind of like lengthy editorial note, like as if I was, you know, an editor being like everything that's wrong with this chapter and how it's going to be fixed. And like sometimes if I am really stuck on a chapter and I feel like, okay, I really need to, like it's not getting unstuck and I don't know what to do about it, so I'm just going to have to move on. If I write myself this like letter of like everything that's wrong and like how it probably can be fixed, then usually I can kind of write the next chapter even though the previous one isn't fully working. It's silly because it's like, well, don't you already kind of know all that in your head? But for some reason, it's like if it's on, it's like it needs to be on the screen like immediately before the next chapter break or page break, you know? Because if I scroll back and that note isn't there, then it's just like, oh, I can't move on.
Right.
I don't know. That's just a silly thing, but it helps me.
No, that's a great idea. Basically, you're writing yourself an edit letter, and that's wonderful. And especially if you can get that outside perspective, as if you're a completely different person who's never read this before, you know, and be a bit of a harsh critic, you can really find holes in your work.
I feel like most authors don't need help finding holes in their work.
That's true.
I feel like it's almost an unhealthy compulsion.
Yeah. Yeah, to do it to a degree. Don't make a don't make a career of it, because then you'll just be miserable.
Try not to take any glee from the activity either.
Exactly.
you will follow this process through the end of your book chronologically, because that is your preferred method. Then you will get to the end of the first draft, which is already, each chapter has already had three passes at this point.
Yes.
Then, does it go in a drawer? Do you have a period of reflection? Do you jump right back in? Do you send it to a reader? What happens when you get to the end of that first version?
Well, I take a little break, a few weeks, 2-3 weeks, and try to have a normal life and not think about it. And then I'll go back and read it through and hope that it makes some kind of sense. Do some revision notes. At a certain point, you have to hand it off to someone else to see what they think. My first reader is my husband. God bless him. He reads these things, and if he laughs in the right places and is touched in the right places and is having a great adventure reading it, then I know I'm on the right lines. The thing is, when you give your work to someone who loves you, they're always going to see the best in it, and they're always going to say the nice things. So then you have to find someone who perhaps doesn't love you quite as much and get an alternate point of view for someone who will just be quite happy to crush your dreams and have no compunction about pointing out every tiny little flaw, and you need that person too, and you both actually need both. You need someone who loves you and someone who, you know, they kind of like you, but they're not going to sugarcoat anything. And if, once you've got through those two people, then you know it's ready to share to a wider critique group.
So who is your person who sort of likes you?
Just this week, actually, a wonderful woman, Gabby Coatsworth, who runs one of my local writers' groups, read The Brass Queen, and she loved it, which is fabulous, but she also found typos, which I thought had been eliminated centuries ago. I was shocked and appalled at the things she found, because I'm like, I know I fixed that. What happened since this strange draft appeared through some interdimensional portal with new errors in? I don't know how it happened, but I was so grateful for her editor's eye that she found all these things. And that's what you really need. You need someone who can step back and say, oh, you're talking about the goddess Britannia here in this scene, but you've written it Britannica, like the encyclopedia. It's like, no, that didn't happen, no. And then you hide under a desk and sob, and then eventually you come out. And this is after this draft has been through countless revisions. So these things are still there, and I encourage your listeners just to keep sharing that work, because someone will find something that you swore was fixed 1,000 times and it isn't. So keep on sharing, that you will always find something new.
Oh my goodness. That experience of finding a typo that you thought you were certain, it's so mad. Especially yeah. when you see a finished product, like it's a printed book, and you're like, no, I fixed that typo.
Yes, exactly.
And then in the back of your head, the only thing I've ever been able to tell myself is, I must make this mistake over and over and over, and I must have made it 99 times and found 98 of them, and that's the one I didn't catch.
Yes.
And it's just, it's a terrifying feeling.
Absolutely. It will now haunt you to the end of your days that you made that one typo.
So awful. So you mentioned local writing groups, and I know we talked a little bit about that right before we started recording. What kind of organized groups of writers are you a part of?
I remember various writing groups, some online, some in person. I was lucky enough to be picked in a contest, an online Twitter contest called Pitch Wars. So Pitch Wars gave me access to a community of people who had entered this contest, in which you win a 2-month mentorship with experienced writers. I was lucky enough to get wonderful mentors, Marty Mabry and Leonie Kelsall, and they helped me to shape my novel, The Brass Queen, into something truly readable, I hope. And as a byproduct of entering that contest, I joined a Facebook group of the other mentees. So I'm a member of the 2017 Pitch Wars mentee group. And that group has been wonderful. There has been so much support and love for each other's successes and failures and advice given and friendships made. And it's just been really great, inclusive group that where everybody really is out for each other's success. So that was my first experience of being part of a larger group, and I highly recommend entering contests and so on that have that kind of support system available to you if you win a place, because it can really change the way you feel about writing. You feel like you're part of a community rather than an isolated writer sitting in a corner somewhere typing on a typewriter. I've also, through another contest, the RWA Golden Heart Contest, become a member of a finalist group there. We're called the Persisters because we're all ladies and we keep on persisting at this writer's business through the years, because let's face it, you need persistence probably more than anything else. I think it's even more important than talent in the end, is just to keep on keeping on and creating work no matter what happens. And they've again been wonderfully supportive and just a great bunch of ladies. We have a lot of fun online. So these are people I've never met in person, but those online groups have been really important. As for local groups, I joined my local chapter of the RWA, who have monthly meetings where there's all kinds of craft advice given and lectures and so on, and guest authors coming in, which has been very helpful. Again, a wonderful bunch of intelligent professional women who are all trying to make it in this fairly tough industry, and it's just been a great experience. And I'm also a member of the Fairfield County Writers Group, who have monthly write-ins and an online Facebook group, and the Westport Writers Rendezvous, run by the wonderful Gabby. And that is actually an accountability group. So essentially you show up once a month and you say, hey, I'm working on this. I had this success. I had this failure. And these are my goals for the next month. And the next month you show up and you say whether or not you achieved your goals. And there's nothing more to it than that, except that having that accountability once a month really helps keep people on track, that they're going to have to face a group of people and admit, oh, well, sorry, no, I just sat and ate cupcakes all month and I didn't do a darn bit of writing. The honesty required is touching. People do admit when they don't get anything written, but when they do, we all cheer each other on, and that's been wonderful. So I highly recommend both online groups and in-person groups to your listeners as a way of just keeping yourself going.
The ones from the contest, I'm guessing you found online.
Yes.
How did you find the accountability group and the local group? How did you get connected with those people?
I actually went on to Meetup and look for local groups that were meeting in the area, and that's how I found those.
Awesome. That's fantastic. We are strong advocates of finding groups, especially for mental health and,
yes,
and for community for authors. It's so, so very important.
Yes.
Now, Meetup, did you find it was pretty easy? You go on Meetup and you found a group right away? Did you have to go on kind of an extended hunt? Like, how did that play out?
Well, here in Connecticut, it's tremendously easy to find a writing group. I could probably throw a rock from my garden and hit about 10 writers group because everybody's writing a novel. And if they're not writing a novel, then their sister, brother, aunt, mother, father, dog, they're all writing novels. So there was pretty much loads and loads of writers groups here. If you're in a more remote location, I think it might be a bit trickier to find an actual in-person group. So I think your best recourse in that sense, in that situation, is to just start your own. Find other people who are willing to meet up over coffee or wine or whatever your favorite tipple is, and just share some war stories about, oh, writing is hard, but I'm getting there, and you can do it, and it's just, it really does boost the spirits.
That is something we have heard over and over, and it always warms both of our hearts, I think, because we are such avid encouragers of finding a community.
Yes.
Because of the isolation of writing, and every time it's verified for us that it's valuable for people. And also things like Meetup or library groups have been helpful to people. We always really appreciate that little verification that we're not crazy people. We are encouraging people to do the right thing. Thank goodness.
Or we're all crazy in the same way, which is also comforting.
Yeah, which is also very comforting. Maybe even more comforting.
Yes.
From our conversation, you've been working on the same novel and entered it into contests, and it is something that you have been editing for a while. How many stages, editorial stages, as well as kind of readers, would you say that your current project has gone through at this point?
Gosh, that is an excellent question. I would say I've probably gone through edits myself and with my mentors at least 20 times. Yeah, and it's about a 350-page novel, so there's been a lot of edits. This is the first piece of fiction I've written as an adult.
Okay.
I was foolish enough to just decide to start writing a novel, and did so without any background in writing or writing classes at all. I did have an English Lit degree, so many centuries ago I read a lot of books, but that doesn't necessarily prepare you for writing. So how I started was I said to my husband, oh, you know, I'm thinking of writing a novel, and he was terribly encouraging, and I said, but I don't know where to start, and he suggested maybe taking a writing course. Like, oh, right, exactly, that's why I married you, that's a good idea. So I looked online and I found a gentleman called David Farland, who is a New York Times best-selling science fiction and fantasy author, and he presents these wonderful online writing courses, and I signed up for one. And my second assignment was a world-building exercise, and I basically wrote what is the first chapter of The Brass Queen, my novel. And David's comments upon it were so encouraging that that's what inspired me to write the entire novel. So I highly encourage people to look into these online writing courses with established authors and see if you can find someone who will read your work and give you honest feedback and say, you know, you have something here. You should take this and run. And I've been running with it for 2 years now, and I think it's finally complete, although, as I said, I did just find these typos this week. But it's been through quite a bit. I've also shared it with one or two friends, trusted friends, who will give me good feedback. And some of the feedback's been surprising. Like, for instance, one gentleman friend of mine who's not known for being terribly emotional or anything, read it and wanted more romance, you know, to have had women read it and want more action, you know, and whatever they want, I give it to them. I add that right in, and it's just been a great process, but I'd say at least 20 times.
Oh, wow. Now that you've had this, you've obviously won some contests, you've had some mentorships, you've gone through 20 edits, yeah. You've had dozens, if not more, people read the book. Has it been to agents? Is the plan to go send it to editors? Where is it at in that part of the process?
Oh, sure. Well, I started querying after Pitch Wars, and I'm happy to say I signed with a wonderful agent at the end of February. She's a wonderful agent. Her name is Natalie Grazian of Martin Literary Management, and she has had a vision for The Brass Queen, which has taken it to new heights. She saw ways that I could improve it, that I had never thought of before, and we went through two more revisions, and she's just added a great layer of a slight dark fantasy layer beneath all the humor and the adventure, and a more inclusive worldview of the British Empire and so on, which has just really just added an extra depth to it. So she has been a great advocate. She's put together a proposal, and we are about to submit this to a select handful of science fiction and romance publishers to see what they think. And hopefully there'll be some good news in the next, oh, I don't know, year to 10 years that someone will actually like to publish this. So I'm hopeful. I mean, you can't control that part of the process, but the experience so far of writing the novel and all the connections I've made have been so great. Even if this isn't picked up, then I've certainly got more novels in me that I'm working on right now, and we'll just see what happens.
Are you also, obviously you said you had two more rounds of revisions with your agent.
Yes.
But have you begun writing new projects as well?
I have. I call it Firefly Meets Downton Abbey. It's basically...
I'm sold already. Where do I buy this book?
So, well, hopefully, you know, at a bookstore near you in, I don't know, about 3 years, 2, 3, 10 years' time. But it's essentially a sort of British Empire extrapolated into outer space with derring do, romance, adventure, comedy, the whole nine yards, and it's so much fun to write, and hopefully it's going to be great to read as well.
That sounds like a lot of fun. So you have persisted on The Brass Queen for quite a while.
Yes.
What was it about this book and this idea or this community or any of those factors that made you say, okay, this book is something that I'm going to continue to persevere on, continue to grind away at, continue to work on?
Well, the short answer to that is David Fallon's encouragement. He said, after reading that first chapter, that if I finished the book, he would read it and give me his feedback. And that was all I needed to know that someone, a very talented person, a very generous person, would read it and let me know what they think. And the gauntlet was down. I didn't want to let him down. I didn't want to contact him a year later and say, oh, sorry, I couldn't finish it. I'm going to take up knitting instead. No, I felt this was an opportunity. It was very gracious of him to make that offer, and I definitely didn't want to let him down or myself down. So I was committed to doing it, and I did it. Now, it's probably not the smartest thing to do, to write an entire novel when you haven't written a work of fiction before, or at least not since infant school, but that was the challenge, and I just decided to do it. And sometimes just setting that goal and keeping on is what it takes.
You can never not write your first book. It has to be your first book.
So
you have to, you mean it's going to be the first one no matter what, so you have to push through. But it is fantastic to hear that the right encouragement at an early stage can give a person that kind of motivation. And I think when you talk about the number of communities you're involved with and the mentorship opportunities from things like Pitch Wars, I think it should be great encouragement even to people who are maybe one or two books in and that have been published or not teaching a course every year, to say, hey, if you meet someone who you see a spark in, to encourage them a little bit early could give them the motivation for 2 years to persevere and get to the point where they are about to start querying publishers. That's a fantastic motivation, I think, for people both starting and for people who are further in.
Absolutely. You never know. The simplest comment, the simplest piece of praise or advice might completely change someone's life. This has changed my life in a very positive way, and I couldn't be more grateful to all the wonderful mentors and critique partners and the people in the groups I've met. Everybody's been wonderful. There are so many generous people in the writing community who are just ready and willing to help you. So just reach out your hand, and I'm sure someone will take it and will be happy to help you along your journey. And hopefully you do the same thing as you move along, that to help other new writers who are looking for that first word of encouragement.
I am going to take us, we've been moving down one direction very quickly, and I'm going to take a hard right turn here and ask a question that might be a little bit different.
Sure.
So from your bio, you're UCB trained, so that's the Upright Citizens Brigade. That's an improv theater in New York.
Yes, that's right. I narrowly survived the intensive training in New York. It's quite something.
I mean, I'm not sure if they would rankle at it being called a writing philosophy, but there's definitely a creative philosophy that's pretty structured and has kind of rules about game of the scene and that kind of stuff. Do you find that your training in that area influences how you write your scenes? I know you said that when people say add this or add that, you say yes and you do. That might be part of that philosophy and that training. Do you think that practice and philosophy has influenced how you approach putting things onto the page?
It has, in both a physical and a mental way. Mentally, the yes and, someone postulates a theory or adds an item, you can say yes and. Once we have this, then we can have that. So just being open to ideas from other people and being able to work with other people's ideas really helps you in your writing, because they may have one idea that sparks an idea with you and it grows and grows. Just be open to that influence. Always say yes. But physically as well, I actually improv my dialogue, which may be a weird acting thing, but when I say I write my dialogue, because I do a lot of my drafts using audio tools, when I say I'm writing, I'm really acting it. I'm walking around the room as my heroine, Constant Holt Whistle. I'm stomping around and I'm saying, "Wow, how dare you, sir?" Blah, 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 blah. And I'm really into the role and really go through the emotions that she's feeling. I'm doing the body language. I'm putting the emphasis on the voice. I really feel it. I feel the scene, and I'm imagining everything around me and so on. And so I think improving your scenes can really help you to bring a vitality and a sense of fun to your chapters that maybe you can't get any other way. Admittedly, you may want to warn your neighbors, friends, family, and so on what you're doing first, because otherwise they are going to think you're completely mad. But you know, once you've done that, you've told everyone, yes, I'm going to pace around the room being an army general for the next hour. Is that okay? Oh, okay, great. And off you go. And just really have fun with it. And I think you'll find that your dialogue is more realistic, and it's an awfully great way to get out a lot of angst, writer's angst and so on, because you're just playing, you're having fun. And that's what improv can give you. You have fun with it.
I feel like you just accidentally gave us a line that like deserves a story to be written around it, which is someone popping their head in the room and saying, I'm going to go off to stomp around as an army general for an hour or so. Yeah. Is that all right? And everyone going, oh yeah, sure.
Welcome to my household.
So one thing we talked about a lot is that people are reading your book, and some of it sounds like you were handing a manuscript off to one person at a time and getting some feedback. Are you doing anything that might be considered like a formalized beta reader process, where you distribute your book to 5 to 10 people and gather feedback. Is that part of one of the things you were doing to get responses from people?
I know. I think that is a great way to do it, but mine's been a little more selective, possibly because I take on one person's comments at a time. I think about it and mm-hmm. I see where those changes might be made and so on. So I like to focus just on one person at a time, one audience member at a time, one reader at a time, and work through rather than going out to a group. Because I think if I got 8 feedbacks at the same time, it might be a little overwhelming. The only exception to that is entering a writing contest where they give feedback from judges. I've done that quite a lot. Usually they just focus on the first chapter or the first 3 chapters, and you may get 3 or 4 judges writing back score sheets and so on. They're very popular in the RWA, these contests, and they've been great. And in that case, I read all 3 or 4 judges and will apply it to that first chapter or 3 chapters and so on. So that's the only time where I'll grow a group one. Other than that, it's just one person, one reader at a time.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's interesting. I think there's obviously it's all very personal and everything works the right way for each individual person. But I typically go for more like what you described as that judge's experience when I'm getting feedback, is to try and do a round where it's about 3 people or 5 people at a time, mainly for the specific reason that I guess most of my like friends and family and reader critique circle, like other writers who I work with, are very opinionated. And so I kind of need like a jury, yeah. You know, because I'll have Paul will read something and just be like, this is garbage. It's stupid. I don't care. Whatever. And then Pam will be like, okay, maybe. Oh, I like it. This works. Yeah. So it's like, so sometimes it's helpful to me to get kind of the like counteracting or like find out, because when they all agree, then I know like whatever they said is for sure the right thing. But sometimes I'll get a strong opinion that conflicts with kind of my own view of the book. And it's helpful to see like, do I get that from just one person and no one else thinks that? Or is it a consistent theme? But I understand what you mean about it's a lot of work to like digest when someone gives you feedback, especially the more detailed feedback getting. So I can certainly understand going through one by one as well. But it's interesting just kind of the different ways that you can do that.
Yes.
And that, look, I have a brief expulsion of air that carries a lot of weight. There's layers to the meaning. You can. There's a lot of forethought in that. I try to, nonverbal communication is very important. This might be something that you haven't even thought of yet, but you're a voice actor. You mentioned that you do a lot of stuff for corporate things. Have you begun to dream about doing your own audio version of your book?
I have dreamt it many times, and I've actually recorded with my good friend George Ledoux, who's a wonderful voice actor. We actually recorded one chapter from the middle of The Brass Queen, and it's up on my website, elizabethchatsworth.com, strangely enough, and you can listen to that audio chapter if you're interested. And we really had fun with it, recording this in the studio, and we added sound effects and music. So it's a little 8-minute chapter that gives you a flavor of the book. If you have the opportunity to record on your own computer, you don't need fancy sound effects, you don't need music or so on. If you have that, that's great. But it's just great to hear a chapter or a few pages from your own book so that you can really get a feel for what your audio listeners would hear if they were listening to your own audio book. And it's just fun. And it's also something you could use as a marketing tool. You can put it on your website and so on for people to listen to.
Yeah, that sounds really cool.
Since you are a voice actor and you're working either in the studio or going to a studio in a collaborative environment, do you find that that process has in any way informed how you take and receive feedback, how you try different things? Has that given you a freedom or any kind of approach similar to how improv might in your writing?
I think we come back to the yes and situation where when you're in a commercial recording environment, everyone is giving you suggestions. You're wearing headphones. You have people in marketing departments who are making suggestions on how best to present their product. You may have an engineer or a producer chiming in. And everybody's opinion is valid. You have to hear them all, and then you have to interpret them so that you give the best performance, so that everybody is getting a little bit of what they want. There's no such thing as perfection, but if you're able to make people happy, if everyone is hearing what they want to hear, then you've done your job. And it's very much the same with writing and editing. If you're getting feedback from readers, they may not be exactly correct in when they say, oh, change it to this, change it to that. But if they have the feeling that something isn't working, they're probably right. And you should respect that and try and make those changes to make them comfortable, to make them happy, especially if it's more than one person saying the same thing. So I never see it as a criticism. I just see it as a reflection of the world around me. And you just try and respond to that and be as open and positive about all the feedback you get as you can be.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Well, we're coming up on an hour, which is usually when we try to wrap. So I think this has been a great conversation, and I really appreciate you taking the time. We have two questions that we always close with, but in your case, I'm adding a special bonus question, which I will ask first, which is, you said that David Farland read your first chapter and then said if you wrote the book, he would read the whole book. So did you give it back to him?
He sure did, and he gave me the best compliments. He said that he laughed out loud throughout, and presumably at the right points where I actually intended that to happen. And he gave great constructive criticism, and he's been very enthusiastic. And even now, as I'm starting to go into the publishing process and submissions and so on, we're still in touch, and he's waiting for good news, and so am I. One day, hopefully, I'll be able to say, thank you, David. By the way, check the acknowledgements page in this book. You're there because got this started. So I couldn't thank you enough.
Yeah, very cool. Okay, then we have two more questions, which are maybe somewhat easier. The first one is, we've talked all about what you're writing, but what are you reading these days?
Oh, gosh. Well, I read all sorts. I read science fiction and fantasy and romance. I'm just about to start a new book called Bellwether by Susanna Kearsley, which is a wonderful historical romance. I'm actually meeting her in a few weeks for afternoon tea, believe it or not. And I know that sounds ridiculous for an English person to be meeting someone for afternoon tea, but that is exactly what we're doing. That's what she suggested as part of a group with a couple of other Golden Heart finalists. So I'm really looking forward to that. So essentially I'm swatting up on all her books to make sure that should she, for instance, happen to mention, well, you know, on page 63 of Bellwether, I can nod knowingly and say, yes, exactly. So I've read them in the past. They're great books, but I just want to make sure I've really got a handle on everything that's going on here.
Fantastic.
Very cool.
And then where can people find you online?
I'm at www.elizabethchatsworth.com.
Oh my God, you do that like such a voice actor. That's amazing. I threw you a softball and you were like, okay, I got this.
Yes.
Say it again when I'm not interrupting you, though.
No, that's okay. You can find me at www.elizabethchatsworth.com. I'm also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
Okay, perfect. Oh, my goodness. Well done.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Well, this has been a wonderful conversation, and thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I've really enjoyed it. It's been a pleasure to meet you.
So much fun, but I do feel like a mumbly mush mouth now after listening to Elizabeth talk. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you do like it, leave us a rating, review, subscribe, tell your friends to listen to it, share it on your social media, whatever you want to do. Andrew and I do these because we are fascinated and passionate about author process and constantly amazed at how authors take different, unique journeys to get to the same endpoint, a finished book that we all get to enjoy, but also because it's amazing research for beta books, which is our software project we work on together. BetaBooks is software that helps authors privately share their manuscript with trusted readers, track reader progress, collect feedback, and then sort, collate, and search that feedback to have a good edit that takes advantage of all those beta readers. If that sounds fascinating to you, check it out at betabooks.co. If you have any questions about the podcast or about BetaBooks, please email us at hello@betabooks.co. And as always, good writing.